Deep Flatus, the special features from theflatusshow.com. Switching off to see Dallas. From Doris Lessing's collection of essays, Prisons We Choose to Live Inside. During the Korean War, the United States government was astounded to find that American soldiers were confessing to all kinds of crimes they had not committed. This was because of brainwashing techniques applied by the North Koreans. As a result of this, the United States began intensive research into brainwashing and indoctrination. This research has gone on ever since and has provided an enormous mass of information about society and how it operates, which could, I believe, transform us, transform our lives, how we view ourselves. This bit of history has interesting facets. One is that one may see how governments of all kinds and priesthoods have used brainwashing techniques to control their subjects for thousands of years. It is interesting to speculate to what extent it was pragmatic, how much based on conscious expertise. But it was certainly a step up in social self-consciousness when a powerful, modern government instructed its experts to investigate an area which until then had been dark and secret, to investigate it as dispassionately as anthropologists are supposed to when they examine the habits of a primitive tribe. I remember the Korean War well. It was a very horrible war, but has been so overshadowed by the Vietnam War that it is remembered very little, except when a television company decides to put on MASH again. It was also horrible because it happened so soon after World War II, a war which should have been enough, some people believed, foolishly, it turned out, to put the world off war forever. It was the height of the Cold War. There was a lowering, ugly, paranoid atmosphere. Suddenly, the communists announced that the Americans were dropping material infected with disease germs onto their enemies and committing other atrocities well beyond the level of atrocities licensed by war. Some people simply refused to believe it. Some people believed it instantly, without further examination. Some fell into a gloomy, anxious state of suspended judgment, repeating, as one has to do, "In wartime, the first casualty is truth." The trouble was, something was lacking. What was lacking was information. The information that we lacked then was about brainwashing techniques. Now, when I look back, I am surprised by something that did not strike me at all at the time. It is this. There had been plenty of recent examples of brainwashing. For instance, in the show trials in Russia in the 30s and in Czechoslovakia, where people confessed to quite ridiculous crimes. And one could have contemplated with benefit the long history of witch hunting, when women confessed, often without torture, to crimes. But it was as if some jump in our understanding had not taken place. We were not able to put things together in a way that made sense. On the one hand, there were all those American soldiers admitting to all kinds of horrors. On the other, it was not possible to believe the United States government had ordered them, even though everybody is properly suspicious about what all governments are prepared to do in wartime. But we could not fit these facts together in a way that made sense. A jump forward in our understanding had not taken place. It is this jump forward that, to my mind, is the most powerful force in social evolution, a movement into greater objectivity shown in the public sphere when the United States government ordered its servants to investigate brainwashing techniques, which, by definition, had to mean techniques sometimes used by itself, used often unconsciously and pragmatically. We are all of us, to some degree or another, brainwashed by the society we live in. We are able to see this when we travel to another country, are able to catch a glimpse of our own country with foreign eyes. There is nothing much we can do about this except to remember that it is so. Every one of us is part of the great comforting illusions, which every society uses to keep up its confidence in itself. These are hard to examine, and the best we can hope for is that a kindly friend from another culture will enable us to look at our culture with dispassionate eyes. But while these great half-conscious or unconscious processes are hard to examine, it is easy to study brainwashing and indoctrination in smaller contexts, for they go on all the time. For instance, take the cults and the sects that proliferate. Brainwashing has three main pillars or processes, by now well understood. The first is tension, followed by relaxation. This one is used, for instance, in the interrogation of prisoners when the interrogator is alternatively harsh and tender. One moment a sadistic bully, the next a kind friend. The second is repetition, saying or singing the same thing over and over again. The third is the use of slogans, the reducing of complex ideas to simple sets of words. These three are used all the time by governments, armies, political parties, religious groups, religions, and always have been used. While I said before, it is interesting to speculate to what an extent the use of these methods is unconscious, it is more to our point here to remember that there is a difference between some sergeant major using these methods to break in raw recruits, because he is doing what his kind have always done, and some sophisticated operator knowing exactly what he is doing. In a certain university, not 1,000 miles from here, as they say in the fairy tales, there is a researcher who has discovered that he can make a true believer, let us say a Christian Scientist, but it doesn't matter what, or a person who is sure the world is flat, or that the world will end on Friday the 13th of the next leap year, and using classical brainwashing techniques, turn this faithful one first into a Seventh-day Adventist, then into a Stalinist communist, then into a liberal, then into a feminist, then into a hardline atheist. When all these changes have been accomplished, and they can be done in the space of a few days, and while this person is a feminist, Stalinist, convinced capitalist, that is what she or he is, absolutely and definitely and finally, and prepared to die for it. But when all these changes have been gone through, the hapless one is returned to his or her former faith, let us say, convinced the world will end on Friday the 13th. His or her brief periods as atheist, capitalist, etc., are now regarded as the merest whimsies on the part of the researcher, and the present faith, whatever it happens to be, is the true one. Anyone who does not believe that the world will end on Friday the 13th is at the best misguided, but probably a liar, wicked, morally disgusting, to be avoided. The natural reaction of almost everyone hearing this particular bit of social research is to assert, silently or loudly, "Of course I would never succumb like that silly person. I would be immune." And whether said aloud or silently or said at all, we can also hear the implicit, "Because my beliefs are the correct ones." But no. Alas, alas, for all of us, every one of us would succumb. That is, unless we were suffering from certain types of schizophrenia. The more sane we are, the more likely we are to be converted. But we may comfort ourselves with this, that brainwashing is usually not permanent. We may be brainwashed by conscious or unconscious manipulators, but we may brainwash ourselves. Not uncommon this, but it usually wears off. Meanwhile, for some people, this experiment I have just described is like a dawn after a long night. The end of the age of belief is in sight. You would think the whole world would have cried out in relief and hope. Soon, soon we will have left behind the age of belief and its wars and tortures and hatred of another type of believer. Soon we will be free, and as all the philosophers and sages have recommended, we will all live our lives with minds free of violent and passionate commitment. But in a condition of intelligent doubt about ourselves and our lives, a state of quiet, tentative, dispassionate curiosity. What? All of us? Everybody? Including all those raging fanatics out there with their ridiculous ideas? All prepared to say, it is the end of the age of faith. We will each one of us give up the flattering and comforting idea that only I am right? Well, obviously, a desire to believe in a golden age dies hard. And here am I with my version of it. But joking apart, it does seem to me that there is a new thing in the world when even a few people can examine ourselves so coolly. If you want to investigate brainwashing in small doses, in small ways, then join one of the sects who will use, probably unconsciously, these brainwashing techniques. Of course, you take the chance that you will fall victim to them. Instead of the attitude, what a wonderful opportunity to examine this fascinating social process, you may suddenly find yourself crying, "At last I've discovered the truth! This group of people I so coldly decided to investigate are the possessors of truth. They are my true family. They want me to become part of them, and I will, because I understand that all the people outside this family are lost souls. They are no good. They don't understand. They are scum and rubbish. But anyway, I don't want to think about them at all. I need my own new family because the world is a terrible place and the arena for unceasing struggle and conflict and a battleground between good and evil. God and the devil are communist and capitalist and my new friends, and I will fight together on the side of the good. I must not be soft towards my own family or my former friends because my first duty is to my new family, my real one, and they really care for me. They understand me, but my former family did not really love me and understand me. Besides, I need a wholehearted and pure attitude because my new group, my allies, have so many enemies who want to destroy us, and I must be prepared to fight for what I believe in and kill if necessary. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and one day we will have a perfect, good, noble, free world, but only we, I and my new family, and the people who believe in us can create it. If you have not succumbed to this, and a great many people have involuntarily submitted to the process, myself included, and if you think it's a bit risky, well, it is very easy to watch these processes at work in the hands of government and, of course, by advertisers. Watch television adverts, for instance. Or how about the Falklands War? Let us discuss it without prejudice. Never mind whether I agreed with it or not. I have friends who exclaim that the worst part of that war was watching our country suddenly reverting to what they described as outworn jingoism and simple-minded patriotism. Why outmoded? Any nation can be made to revert to drum beating, to dancing around a campfire, waving tomahawks, metaphorically speaking, by any leader able to use the appropriate phrases and war cries. It occurs to me here to wonder that since it is so easy to arouse the primitive in a nation, which may easily revere the leader for doing it, there are the leaders who instead choose to appeal to a nation's higher instincts. Who are they? When Mrs. Thatcher was elected for her second term of office, she employed Saatchi & Saatchi, a big advertising firm, to handle her campaign. These people used every trick in the book, from turns of phrase calculated to arouse easy emotions, to the colors of her dresses and the curtains she stood in front of, to calculated entrances and exits, and the use of the media. Meanwhile, her high-minded socialist opposition despised these tricks and the media. We were able to watch exactly how Mrs. Thatcher's campaign was stage-managed in a very witty, clever television program. When I say we, I mean a minority of the nation who watched it, but I would have been in favor of making it compulsory viewing. We have now reached the stage where a political leader not only uses skillfully time-honored rabble-rousing tricks, see Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, but employs experts to make it all the more effective. But the antidote is that in an open society, we may also examine these tricks being used on us. If that is, we choose to examine them, if we don't switch off the See Dallas or whatever instead. The point I am making is that information we have been given about ourselves as individuals, as groups, as crowds, as mobs, is being used consciously and deliberately by experts, which almost every government in the world now employs to manipulate its subjects. More and more, we will be able to observe governments using the results of the research into brainwashing, but only if we wish to observe, only if we are determined not to fall victim to them. Meanwhile, it is interesting that those people who like to regard themselves as the armies of the good, the well-intentioned, disdain much such means. I'm not saying that they should use them, but they will often refuse even to study them, thus leaving themselves open to being manipulated by them. As an experiment, I tried talking about this subject to a series of my friends who are part of the well-intentioned movements of our time, such as Greenpeace, various types of socialism, people against nuclear war, campaigners for civil liberties, for the rights of prisoners, the abolition of torture, and so on. Everyone reacted identically, emotionally, with dislike and distrust, as if it were in some way reactionary or anti-libertarian or anti-democratic to look at the behavior of human beings, at our behavior, dispassionately, as something that one can learn to predict. Our opponents have no such inhibitions. Of course, if you are a member of a group that by its own definition is right, good, and true, with all the complacent attitudes that go with this, such as that one's opponents are evil, then of course it is hard to stand aside, hard to take that necessary step upwards on the ladder into objectivity. But it does seem to me sometimes that Thatcher's last election exactly summed it up. There she was, her every gesture, exit, entrance, smile, remark, stage-managed according to very sophisticated social prescription. While Michael Foot was grumpily and high-mindedly slamming a train window in the faces of some inquiring reporters, we observe India's Rajiv Gandhi winning an election with the aid of a friend, a film star who is the idol of millions of people. In the United States, a film star is the most popular president, I have heard said, of the century. It is not without a strong feeling of unreality that I've listened to people discussing why Reagan is so successful, without it ever being mentioned that it is just possible that people may be voting for him because he has already, as it were, been elected at the box office. Government by show business. Well, every authoritarian government understands this very well. Think of Hitler's great mass demonstrations when millions of people were whipped up into hysteria, or the enormous military parades of the Soviet Union using beautiful children, girls, dancing, flowers, songs, side by side with fear and threat. Or our new terrifying technologies go hand in hand with the new psychological information. And sometimes technology leads to unforeseen results. I have read an account of how soldiers destined for the front line are desensitized by deliberately exposing them to brutality in such a way that they slowly lose their capacity for seeing the people they have to attack or interrogate as human. This is a controlled and skilled process where trainers know exactly what they are doing and how to take their charges slowly, stage by stage, until they can torture or kill without any emotion whatsoever. There have been protests about this in various countries recently, but while I'm sure no fewer soldiers are processed in this way, there is less noise about it. But what strikes me is this: technology, television, cinema to be precise, in this case, is doing exactly the same process, exposing us to brutality of every kind so that we lose our sensitivity to it. We lose our sensitivity in a random and unpredictable way. Pictures of the Ethiopian famine rouse the conscience of people in many countries, but pictures of victims from another part of the world may not cause us to react. Not long ago, we were told that a very large number of people were to be publicly hanged in Nigeria, and there was practically no world response. Some of us remember, after the Second World War, the shock, the unease expressed around the world when the Soviet Union decided to publicly hang some German war criminals to appease the outrage of the plundered, pillaged, and slaughtered Russian civilians. We were shocked, though we had been through nearly 5 years of horrors. We had supped, and we were full of horrors, but not so full we could not still react. I wonder if anyone would protest now. We have become blunted. We have become desensitized, watching night after night, day after day, year after year. The horrors going on all over the world have desensitized us exactly as those soldiers have been deliberately brutalized. No one set out to brutalize us, to make us callous, but that is what we increasingly are. This is not the result of some cynical expert manipulator deliberately using knowledge of psychology, but an almost haphazard result of our technology. I wonder if perhaps in the future people interested in these things will inquire, what was it that triggered world conscience about Ethiopia, when the same conscience remained unmoved about the famine and suffering caused by the Soviet Union in Afghanistan? There were over 5 million refugees in Pakistan and Iran, over one-third of its population. In Afghanistan, crops were deliberately destroyed by napalm, villages ruined, children crippled by the use of explosives hidden in toys. It has been described as deliberate genocide in certain areas. 1 million civilians have been murdered. People die there, as I write, of starvation, yet there have been no great public campaigns over this. The world's heart has not been opened to the victims in Afghanistan, where there is a Soviet puppet government. But the world's heart is open to Ethiopia, which is under a Soviet puppet government. People have been dying of famine along the countries of the Sahel for a decade and more, but that trigger was not pulled, and people did not react with generosity and compassion until recently. But why not? It is at least an interesting question to ask. Yet there will be people who think that to ask it is callous, or at the very least in bad taste. It seems to me more and more that we are being governed by waves of mass emotion while they last. And while they last, it is not possible to ask cool, serious questions. One simply has to shut up and wait. Everything passes, but meanwhile, these cool, serious questions and their cool, serious, dispassionate answers could save us. Looking back over my life, which has now lasted 66 years, what I see is a succession of great mass events, boilings up of emotion, of wild partisan passion that pass. But while they last, it is not possible to do more than think, these slogans or these accusations, these claims, these trumpetings, quite soon they will seem to everyone ridiculous and even shameful. Meanwhile, it is not possible to say so. I was born as a result of the First World War, which shattered my childhood. It was a war during which national emotions were primitive, vile, and so stupid that now young people can be heard inquiring, but how could they have believed that? Why did they fight? The coming of the Second World War shattered my growing up, and my two marriages were the result of that of this war, which was caused by a ranting and raving lunatic. Communism boiled up in Russia, murdered and destroyed. Yet for a while the violent partisan passions of that revolution spread everywhere and made it impossible to think straight. For some people, in some places, it is still impossible to think straight. China boiled up in revolution, boiled up again in the Cultural Revolution, and set the country back a generation. But while these great social whirlpools or earthquakes or volcanoes were at work, the people who were involved could not talk sense or ask questions or protest. One mass movement, each a set of mass opinions, succeeds another. For war, against nuclear war, for technology, against technology, and each breeds a certain frame of mind. Violent, emotional, partisan, always suppressing facts that don't suit it, lying, and making it impossible to talk in the cool, quiet, sensible, low-keyed tone of voice, which, it seems to me, is the only one that can produce truth. And yet, while all these boilings and upheavals go on, at the same time, parallel, continues this other revolution, the quiet revolution based on sober and accurate observation of ourselves, our behavior, our capacities. In 1,000 universities, laboratories, or in deliberately contrived research situations, information is being collected which could, if we decided to use it, transform the world we live in. But it means making that deliberate step into objectivity and away from wild emotionalism, deliberately choosing to see ourselves as perhaps a visitor from another... deliberately choosing to see ourselves as perhaps a visitor from another planet might see us. It means, and I hope this won't sound too wild, choosing to laugh, the researchers of brainwashing and indoctrination discovered that people who knew how to laugh resisted best. The Turks, for instance, the soldiers who faced their torturers with laughter, sometimes survived when others did not. Fanatics don't laugh at themselves. Laughter is, by definition, heretical, unless used cruelly, turned outwards against an opponent or enemy. Bigots can't laugh. True believers don't laugh. Their idea of laughter is a satirical cartoon, pillorying an opposition person or idea. Tyrants and oppressors don't laugh at themselves and don't tolerate laughter at themselves. Laughter is a very powerful thing, and only the civilized, the liberated, the free person can laugh at herself or himself. When the Shah of Iran was still on his throne, this happened in a village in Persia. A certain quiet, law-abiding, and sensible man called his beautiful and favorite cat Shah and Shah, which is what the great kings of Persia have liked to be called, King of Kings. A village policeman, hearing of this, denounced the unfortunate man to the secret police, and he was thrown into prison and vanished, as people did then and do now, of course, under Khomeini. I have mentioned this incident to supporters of the old regime, only to be told that it was ridiculous, that the Shah himself would have thought so. Ah. But here we are up against a law of society that lawgivers don't take into account at all when they make our laws and then sit back, satisfied that the laws are just and the society a good one. It is this: the people at the top of a government, a department, a ministry, or any institution of government or administration never know what goes on at the lower levels. This accounts for this scene, which is played out every day all over the world in every country, where some small citizen who has been bullied or misgoverned or treated unjustly listens incredulously while some great man or woman, the boss, announces that it is impossible that so-and-so could have happened, under him, under his or her rule, for such a thing would be against the regulations. It would never be tolerated by him or by her. How many times have you or I not sat and watched or listened, amazed at this scene on television or radio? No, certainly not. Of course my policemen don't beat up helpless people in cells, frame the innocent. Of course my officials don't bully helpless people or take bribes. Of course such awful, dreadful injustice, such as you describe, cannot happen. But it does. It just has. It is because, as I have said, people at the top don't know what goes on under them. Sometimes one cynically has to believe that they don't want to know. Or at any rate, they are clearly helpless against this mechanism, which ensures that in every country I have lived in, visited, read about, people at the bottom of the heap are badly treated. Is it not possible for something to be done about this? Well, no, nothing can be done until we have reached that point where we can say that this is so. It will always be so unless there are safeguards. In some countries in the ancient times, there was a checking mechanism set up by the kings who were the authorities of those days. There were government employees whose job it was to go about pretending to be ordinary citizens to check the behavior of officials. If an official was found to be stupid or offensive or bullying or unjust, then he was removed. No official anywhere could ever be sure that the person standing in front of him, apparently helpless, was not a government inspector in disguise. And officials, correspondingly, behaved with more care, and the standard of public service was kept high. That device for improving administration could only have been employed if the administrations in question were able to look very coolly at themselves and to diagnose their own condition and to prescribe for it. There is nothing to stop us doing the same.